This is a podcast from Consilio. We bring people together to create better places.
Hello and welcome to Better Places, the podcast from Consilio where we talk about planning, politics and development. Today our own Sidhu Dwyer sat down with Lambeth's councillor Rosina Chowdhury, deputy leader of the cabinet and member for Sustainable Lambeth and Clean Air. The conversation focused on current challenges and policies that she has overseen not just in Lambeth, but ones that have also had a London-wide effect. The pair explored a number of topics, such as how Councillor Chowdhury's upbringing and decade of experience in local government has shaped her policy outlook, her message to developers about shaping the borough of Lambeth and it being open to sustainable development, Lambeth's race to achieve net zero by 2030, its groundbreaking climate action plan, the borough's transformative approach to the curbside, innovative policies addressing air quality and active travel, and the role of retrofitting in achieving net zero goals. We do hope you enjoy this insightful conversation.
Hello and welcome to the Better Places podcast, where we bring together the people, policies, and explore the places that are shaping our environment, and in this episode, to explore what truly makes our cities livable. I'm Sidhu Dwyer, I'm account director at Consilio, and a public affairs consultant working at the heart of London's planning and property sector. I'm joined today by Councillor Rosina Chowdhury. Welcome, Rosina.
Hi there.
And on this episode, we are going to be exploring all things green, environmental and sustainability. So over the years, I've had the privilege of working closely with many property developers, communities and local authorities to help shape the projects that transform our neighbourhoods across the capital. And as a driver myself, I bring a personal perspective to these conversations and want to look to explore how we create sustainable cities that truly work for everyone, whether they're on foot, two wheels, or even four. It's 2025 and London is in the midst of significant change. With a new Labour government at the heart of Westminster, there's a renewed focus on tackling the climate crisis. We're creating sustainable housing and building better transport networks. London's Labour councils have been working at pace on many of these issues, and today we're spotlighting Lambeth, a borough that's not just embracing change, but it's leading it too. I'm delighted, like I said, to be joined by Councillor Rosina Chowdhury, one of London Labour's most influential voices on sustainability in livable cities. Rosina is Lambeth's cabinet member for Sustainable Lambeth and Clean Air, a role that she's held since 2022, where she spearheaded bold initiatives like the borough's climate action plan and the innovative curbside strategy, which we're going to go into today. She's also served as vice chair of London Council's Transport and Environment Committee, playing a key role in shaping environmental and transport policy across the capital. Rosina brings an impressive depth of experience to her work. She's been a councillor for Streatham Hill East for over a decade, combining her local knowledge with her professional expertise gained from senior roles in public health, social research and policy development at organisations like Public Health England and NatSen Social Research. Councillor Chowdhury's work on London Labour Regional Executive and the National Policy Forum reflects her commitment to driving the Labour Party's agenda on climate action and sustainability, not just locally, but nationally too. So today's conversation, I trust, will be an interesting one. And Councillor Chowdhury, thank you for the time. Rosina, welcome to the podcast, and I really just want to start with you. What drew you into public service, and can you tell us a bit more about what really focuses your career?
Okay. Well, thank you very much for inviting me, Sidhu. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you very much for that lovely introduction. So what drew me into public service and this area? I mean, I'd have to go back a very long time indeed. In the sort of like the early stages of my career when I was a lowly junior social researcher working on resident surveys. And back in the day, we used to do those face-to-face, not telephone, not online, now, like nowadays. And it was doing those surveys and doing qualitative and quantitative research, talking to residents, finding out what were the things that really impacted on their day-to-day lives. You know, we're not talking big national policy issues here. We're talking about dog fouling. We're talking about gully cleaning. We're talking about litter and bins.
All the great pavement politics,
yes,
but they're really nitty-gritty.
Exactly. And those were the things that, you know, when you ask people, spontaneously, you know, what is it that you like about this area or what is it that you don't like about this area? It's those kind of things that came up. And that gave me a really good understanding of what matters to people. And it is about quality of life of people's local spaces, their neighbourhoods. Mm-hmm. That means more to them. And the community as well, bringing people together. My journey into local politics was essentially through more connection with my neighbours. I joined a book group, over a decade ago, and it was, through this book group that I met residents, my neighbours. We talked about the book, but most often we talked about the local area. Mm. We talked about what we didn't like and what we wanted to see improved.
Was this in Streatham then?
Yes, this was in Streatham, yeah. So, and you know, I got those deep insights from people, and you know, often they'd be blaming the government, sometimes they'd be blaming the council. Actually, you know, often they'd be blaming the council.
Well,
but
quite, yeah.
And we were where I lived, it had been a predominantly Lib Dem area for decades. I'd never seen Labour councillors until, you know, we came in 2014.
Why don't you tell us a bit more about that? I mean, obviously I have my own biases there, but what was that campaign like? So you would have been at the heart of probably a small group of your local residents, but they're probably people who really have their finger on the pulse and understand what's going on in the local patches. What led people, do you think, notwithstanding kind of national issues, to swing in your direction?
Well, I think we were... we had the Condem coalition that favoured us, really.
Condem coalition.
That's what I call it. And it was, we were able to use that quite a bit because we said there's limits to what the council can do. If there's austerity, there's no money. This is what this coalition government is doing, Your current, Lib Dem councillors, what can they do? They are aligned with this level of austerity.
Mm.
We made sure that any messages we put out, we connected them to austerity. And because before then, Streatham Hill, my ward, had never been considered, a Labour target seat. But we made hay in 2014, and all three Lib Dem councillors lost their seats.
Well, congratulations. And a decade on, you're still going quite strong.
Yeah.
I think for our listeners and for those that may not be familiar with that part of South London, can you describe your patch? What makes up Streatham Hill East and kind of wider Streatham area?
What makes up Streatham Hill East? Well, or Streatham Hill, as I still prefer to call it, because it's Streatham Hill East under the local authority boundary changes. Mm. And if you're a complete nerd about local government, then you'll understand that. But with the parliamentary boundary changes that came in last year, our wards reverted to pre-2022 wards.
Oh.
I know, it's very confusing. So when we talk about in parliamentary terms, we talk, it's Streatham Hill. Streatham Hill generally and Streatham Hill East. So it's just south of the South Circular, so bordering with Brixton Hill. It's cut through the middle by the A23, a massive road that goes all the way from central London to Brighton, and in effect it kind of breaks up the community a bit. So this is one of the reasons why the ward, those boundary changes came in 2022, because my bit of the ward is on one side of the A23. There's a mix of social housing, we've got massive estates, lots of greenery on the estates, we have a mix of Edwardian and Victorian properties, very kind of red brick houses that were partially owned by the council. So some of our tenants are social tenants, some of them are leaseholders. And there's freehold as well. So it's a real mix in tenure.
It's the story of London. True mixed communities.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we've got, you know, the same issues that all communities have. During the pandemic, some of our, you know, favourite shops and restaurants closed down. But we're slowly seeing a resurgence of those businesses, but things keep changing, and you know, it's and the community is changing as well. Excuse me. But yes, it is a very diverse community as well. Diverse both in terms of in income and in life stage, as well as ethnicity. So it's a lovely community to be representing.
Well, indeed, and probably one that keeps you really quite busy. And I wonder if we could perhaps go back to some of those book clubs and what formed your kind of political action or kind of sprung you into action. What was it about the makeup of your patch, perhaps, that has led you to take on this particular role as Lambeth's cabinet member responsible for sustainable Lambeth and clean air? And I should say, actually, you're also deputy leader of the council.
Yes.
A post that you share with another. So let's really get to the kind of nuts and bolts of it. What was it that drove this agenda that you're taking on to try and reach net zero by 2030?
Wow, that's a big question, and and I can answer it in several ways. But I think I need to bring into it my own background, as someone who is of Bangladeshi origin, and who has experienced flooding and the extreme impact of climate change from the global south. It's something that I've been very, very aware of from a very young age. There was no avoiding, the news from family during the flooding season that occurred in Bangladesh. Also, earthquakes, and the disaster that goes with it. That is something that I grew up with, and it is very much a kind of a thread through my consciousness and my political journey, if you like. The unfairness that people in the global south are feeling the impacts of actions taken by other people elsewhere in much more privileged countries. So there was that, and also the thought that, you know, how is it that countries in the global south have been having to make changes to their lives? So, for example, in Bangladesh, I remember plastic bags were banned about 30, 40 years ago. There was a consciousness that we were recycling, we were reducing,
Something that's taken us, only recently we're starting to impose charges to reduce that. In the global south are really conscious of the impact.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, nothing ever got chucked out. I remember as a child visiting my grandparents' home, and the old pots of Nivea and Pond's cream and old tins of like Bournvita or Ovaltine, all of that was reused, washed out, and you'd store something in it. And there's the old joke about maybe immigrant households in the UK. You open a tin of biscuits and there's no biscuits in there.
You can look through my gran and mum's drawers and find whether it's containers or piles and piles of plastic bags, and I think we could resonate in knowing that it's that conservationist attitude because of some of the impacts that we've had to face with climate change.
Exactly, and it's this culture of not wasting
absolutely
and preserving, conserving, and not throwing stuff out. This underconsumption is seen as something to aspire to. And it's a bit of a joke. I mean, it's a bit of a joke, amongst my family and my wider network. We're like, why do you want to buy that for? You've got this already. Mm. Or this idea, you know, you don't need it, so don't get it. So I think all of that sort of brings me to where I am and what I do now. And it sounds a bit evangelical, but it's not, because I think...
Cardinal pursuit, if you will.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's good, you know, like, you know, the whole people are crocheting and knitting and sewing and mending and darning. And in Lambeth, we've got the Repair Cafe, which, you know, we're promoting because it's about, reusing stuff. And I think that's the kind of stuff that resonates with our communities. And, you know, in the book club, going back to the book club, we used to talk about recycling. Mm. We used to talk about, oh, you know, we should be recycling more. What kind of things can we recycle? What can't we? And sharing tips on, gardening. So, yes, we talked about the book, but like I say, we talked about lots of things. And I think that's, you know, when I talk about the insights I gained from my book club, is that, you know, people want to do the right thing. And when it comes to climate and when it comes to adaptation, mitigation, people really want to do the right thing, but they need to know what to do. And, you know, whether it's, you know, private individuals, businesses, families, big businesses, small businesses, and we have lots of small businesses, all they want is they just need to know what they should be doing. And unfortunately, these last 14 years, we've had no direction from central government at all. The Tories just sat on their hands, or if they weren't sitting on their hands, they put in their, you know, both forefingers in their ears, because they just didn't want to know about climate. You know, I'm not calling them climate deniers, but they were certainly delayers.
I mean, they may have come close. I mean,
because it really wasn't on their radar, because all they wanted was, well, latterly, to get Brexit done, and we know how that's turned out. But it's infuriating, because we've gone backwards. Up till 2010, we were leading the way, and then we went backwards, and now we're having to play catch up. When it comes to, and I know we're going to be talking about curbside strategy, when I look at what other European cities are doing, we should be ahead of them. We should be ahead. I know when I look at what Anne Hidalgo's done in Paris on the Rue de Rivoli, and, you know, cutting the amount of traffic going through Paris, when I look at what the mayor did in Barcelona with the super blocks, really inspirational stuff about cutting traffic going through the centre of the city and making it, you know, beautifully livable. When I look at Copenhagen and, you know, how they blocked off a whole part of the city that is just traffic free, because we know that people who walk and cycle spend more money in local shops than people who drive.
And I really do want to delve into that a bit more. And actually, do you know, I was reading in The Guardian yesterday, I think it was John Elledge, had quoted some quite interesting stats, I would have thought, in terms of the average London driver, I believe, spends 101 hours in traffic, which I feel.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Because I'm up in North London in Enfield, and I'm acutely aware of the amount of cars on the road, not least myself. But if you compare that to Paris, it's 97 hours, which is, I mean, it may be four, but it's still a substantial amount. And in places like Dublin, you had a much more reduced number. I think it was 81 in 2024 that was quoted. I wondered if we could just kind of delve into a bit more around the climate action plan, and what are those kind of main drivers that Lambeth's trying to pursue? I know you spoke about you kind of gathered input from residents. What's driving that plan of action?
What's driving a plan of action is just equity and social justice. We have some of the most deprived communities in England, and multi-ethnic communities, younger communities, older people, are most likely to feel the worst impacts of climate, of the climate crisis. Whether it's flooding or whether it's extreme heat, we need to be improving our environment to make sure that our most vulnerable communities don't feel the worst effects. Because, let's face it, the richer you are, the more able you are and more capable you are, and the more capacity you have to be able to mitigate, whether that's by putting in solar panels, putting in heat, air source heat pumps, affording air conditioning or double glazed windows. But that all costs money, and not everyone can invest those huge amounts of money to be able to make them more climate resilient. And that's where that's where government comes in, and that's where councils come in. We've been limited and financially constrained in recent years because we haven't been able to move as fast as possible to do that kind of adaptation and mitigation work.
But to your credit, Lambeth's really taken the lead on this. I mean, you declared climate emergency in 2019, and since then, perhaps you can tell us a bit about the progress that you've made.
Exactly. So, yeah, as you say, we were the first London Council to declare a climate and ecological emergency in 2019. And since then, we've been working at pace to deliver, to ensure that we are net zero ready by 2030. And, it's not just words. They have to be actions. And also, those actions, you do have to have permission as well. Mm. Because some of the things that we're having to do and we're asking our residents to do for us, we need to bring them along with us. Because they're not easy things. I mean, we're way past the point of where it's mitigation. We have to start adapting. And that's things like thinking about, how they make their journeys. If you wanted to go to the shops and you didn't have much time, you'd just jump in your car and you'd go down to the bottom of the road and you'd pop into your supermarket and get some supplies and drive back again. And we're asking people, no, actually, can you, if there's journeys of less than 2 miles, can you walk it or can you cycle it? Or can you think of other ways to do that? And some people might not be able to do that, and that's fine. Not everybody can give up their car, and we understand that. But actually, what we're trying to do is, where people can use sustainable forms of transport, to use that and free up the roads for people who really do need to use their cars. And we're not just talking about, people, blue badge holders, but it could be families. Families who do need the car to get their kids to school on time, maybe, or who need to, get an elderly parent that they care for to hospital appointments or GP appointments. So all of that, by asking, the vast majority of people to change their behaviours, we want to make it easier for the minority that do need help. And already we're starting to see those behaviours changing. And you can only change those behaviours when you create the right conditions. There's no point in telling people to do more of something or less of something if you don't create those conditions. So by asking people to make more sustainable journeys, it's incumbent on us to create safer cycle routes, more cycle lanes, encourage people to take up cycling by, working with micro-mobility companies, bike hire companies.
And is this the big shift?
This is part of the big shift, yes. Thinking about ways to make it easier to make those changes, whether it's by, giving people, free cycle confidence classes, getting people to try out some of the e-cargo bikes that we have dotted around the borough, so they don't have to invest in one; they can hire one. Encouraging.
What's the take-up been like?
It's been really good. I mean, I know, I understand from the company that we work with that in Lambeth, they get the most usage But we want more people to be using those cargo bikes, you know, taking kids to school in them. But then we need to create the infrastructure for that too. So safer cycling routes, more parking for e-cargo bikes as well. The other thing that I wanted to raise was, you know, we want to encourage people to be able to walk more. And that was one of the things, you know, and again, that goes back to my time at Public Health England, where I was doing behaviour change marketing, because it's, you know, it's really easy to sell, you know, salty, spicy, sweet food and sugary drinks and, you know, and telling people to, you know, that as the advertisers of these fast food companies do, and drinks companies and tobacco companies, they're selling things that people want. But actually, behaviour change marketing is really, really difficult because you're trying to sell people the idea of not doing stuff.
And on that point, I wonder, the 15-minute city or neighbourhood is often derided in the right-wing press has been a bit of an issue. I mean, it's a success in places like Waltham Forest, and I know Lambeth is kind of moving towards that with a big shift. What would you say is the... How have you made that possible?
Yeah. So, yes, the 15-minute cities point, you know, people talk about it as though it's some kind of like some conspiracy theory. It's people want to live in neighbourhoods where they can walk to things, whether it's the bank, the post office, the local shops, the supermarket. It's not...
A tube station.
Yeah, a tube station, a bus stop. You know, it's not a big deal. People want to be able to walk to places. And again, going back to the point I was making about public health, if you encourage people to walk more, then they will be healthy. The benefits of walking are so underestimated, because it's you know, not everyone can jog and run, but walking most people can do. Mm. And it's a really effective form of exercise.
Absolutely.
And it's good for public health, it's good for the individual, and it's good for the environment as well. So there's so many benefits to walking, and that's what part of the big shift was, that we wanted to create spaces for people to walk. There's, you know, it's horrible asking people to walk down busy, traffic filled and emissions heavy high roads. You want to create environments where people can walk in a healthy way. We can't, in urban London, we cannot ask people to walk in nature. We've got open spaces, we've got parks, we've got commons, but actually, when people in Streatham walking down to the high road, they're usually walking down the A23. So we want to create more spaces in those public realms that make them destinations for people to walk to. And that means, you know, more places to sit and rest. So if you can't walk for long distances, we're saying that actually, here's a bench that you can break your journey. Here's a parklet with seating, with tables, chairs, planters. So all of that is part of the big shift and reimagining what our local spaces could look like. Spaces where people want to spend with their neighbours, with their friends, enjoying some fresh air.
And on that, Lambeth's kind of livable neighbourhoods, or more commonly known as perhaps LTNs, have really made breakthroughs, both in the press for positive reasons, and there have been some challenges too. I wonder if you could touch on what your vision is for these livable neighbourhoods, and perhaps that's a great segue into Lambeth's curbside strategy that's been making real waves. And for our listeners who perhaps aren't familiar with it, that's about making 25% of Lambeth's curbside more sustainable for use. And that could be for planters or so, which I'm sure you'll touch on. And a factoid that I remember my time in the borough, that I believe if you stacked all of Lambeth's roads from Lambeth, it could reach as far as Edinburgh.
That's right. It's a huge amount of public space. And again, something that drives our passion around the curbside strategy is it's about social justice and equity. Because 60% of households in Lambeth don't have access to a car. yet 94% of the curbside is used to park cars.
God, is it 94%?
Yes, it's 94%. And it feels so unfair that you know, so many of our residents don't have access to that space. And that is one of the largest sort of pieces of public realm that we have control over. And we want to rebalance that, because for too long now, you know, it's been assumed that that space between the carriageway and the pavement, that curbside, is just for cars. And it's become like that when actually, no, it's public space. And if you want to park your car there, you need to pay, right? And you know, if I want to create a parklet there, then yes, that would be paid for too. So, the many ways that we're reimagining and re-envisaging that space is, you know, thinking about parklets and planters and trees, planting trees in the curbside, because we want to make sure that our pavements have 2 meters clearance, and that's the ambition of the curbside, to make sure there's space for people to be able to, you know, people in wheelchairs or mobility scooters to be able to use the pavement without any kind of impediment. The other uses for the curbside space is, you know, using it for micro mobility, so e-bikes and e-scooters, which means that, you know, they won't be cluttering the pavement.
I have to ask. I call them litter bikes because it often feels that you walk around and they don't have the proper station. I read only recently, I think the government or the new Labour government has now given local authorities more powers. So I think e-bikes are good, but we need to find a way to restrict them.
Absolutely.
The area that they can occupy.
Absolutely. And that's something that we've been working on in Lambeth, and, you know, in my role as Vice Chair of London Council as well, we've been heavily lobbying government and the minister. And I'm so pleased to see that in the devolution white paper about giving local authorities, you know, more powers to be able to enforce against, badly parked e-bikes. So it's, but you know, we're putting in more curbside space for people to park their bikes. And it's just a question of making sure that the bike companies ensure that they let their users know that this is where they can park the bikes. So we're making those spaces available. Also, you know, car clubs as well. This is the other way of...
How popular are they? I've never really looked
How popular are they? They have been, and they've been going for some time now. And I think more and more people are using them. We certainly, you know, our ambition is to have... an electric car, club car, on every road in Lambeth where it's possible. And as you know, we're rolling out our own council owned and operated electric vehicle charging points as well. So we're, you know we're serious about decarbonising transport. So we want to make it easier for people to be able to switch to electric vehicles if they're able. I mean, obviously we'd rather people got rid of their cars and if they needed to use a vehicle, to use a car club one, because we want to make it easier for them to do that, and that's where the curbside strategy comes in. We can have vans and car clubs using that space.
On the curbside, and just to kind of shift only slightly to the what would seem positive impact to the local economy, can you perhaps touch on what impact there has been on the local economy and your town centres, and then kind of shifting residents away from their individual cars, what kind of benefit has there been to local shops?
Well, as you know, TfL funded research found that people who walk or cycle to shops or use public transport tend to spend more than people who drive to the shops. And that's certainly
do
what
we
do
you know why that is?
They spend more time. When people drive to shops, they go in, they get what they want, and they come out again. Whereas when you're walking or cycling to the shops, you tend to, wander a bit. I call it meandering, and I love it. I mean, I walk everywhere anyway. So it just means that it gives you the freedom to be able to visit more shops. Whereas if you're a driver and you've parked for 10, 20 minutes, you're not going to hang around.
I do often feel there's an urgency often when I am in a position where you feel like you have to leave or you need to look ahead, and that's when you have more time to meander and explore. That's something that can be quite worthwhile. And I think just touching on that, you'll know that developers play a big role in shaping our boroughs. How is Lambeth making sure that new developments support sustainable travel, like providing enough cycle storage, and how are you working with them more broadly on creating spaces that people actually want to be in?
Yeah, I mean, that's a no-brainer. I mean, any developer that wants to work in Lambeth, with Lambeth, knows, what our position is when it comes to, our passion for having spaces for people. We want to make sure that, our developments are car-free. They take into account that we want people to move around sustainably, making sure that it's that people have spaces to park their bikes. I mean, I would love it, and this is something that I heard about in Amsterdam. Well, my cousin moved to Amsterdam and he was renting a place there, and he said his landlord provided him with a bike and a boat.
Oh, goodness, really? Oh,
yeah.
But this is
what I mean, if we want to encourage if developers are serious about this kind of thing, then they need to be thinking about what incentives they can provide to residents, and no car parks please, but more bike hangers, more spaces to if people have cargo bikes, because they have children to take to school. Thinking about families, thinking about people who have mobility issues as well. So and green spaces, about biodiversity, planting more trees, and creating spaces for people to spend time and create communities. That's what I would say to developers.
And just on that, I think retrofitting is a big topic of debate.
Yep.
The economics of it can be quite challenging. How has Lambeth fared in that space, whether it's retrofitting your own homes, which a number of your estates are perhaps eligible for that kind of transformation, and some of your public buildings, and what kind of work have you been undertaking to improve those?
Yeah, so as from your time in Lambeth, you'll be aware that any kind of retrofitting that we've been able to do has been through bidding for grants, the public sector decarbonisation scheme, which we've been successful in applying and getting money. So we've been able to use that to retrofit our libraries, leisure centres, numerous schools, and I think the next step is housing, and social housing is the next one. But it's really exasperating, because we should be so far ahead. We should be so far ahead on this because we've got the ambition, but we don't have the money. Mm. And just going back to the previous government, turning this whole thing around retrofit into some kind of some Hunger Games approach to the funding is, I don't know how they thought that was sustainable. I mean, this is essential stuff. This isn't about who has the best bid writers. This should be about where there's need.
Absolutely, I do agree. And I think, interjecting there, but the bidding process, which I know that London Councils has been working really hard to lobby government away from that form of process, it makes it quite challenging. Pits local authorities against one another, and it does come down to the skill set, which is important in local authorities, but ensuring that where there are pots of funding, it can be drawn down in a kind of equitable way.
Exactly that. And you know, and I'm hopeful. I'm really hopeful, because at least at least now, and we're 6 months into Labour government, and I remember just feeling a huge sigh of relief, obviously, because, you know, I've been campaigning for a Labour government for so long. But it's like, oh my God, it means we don't have to keep fighting government anymore. Because that was the exhausting thing. Every time we did something in Lambeth, we'd have, you know, there was always a risk that the Secretary of State would kind of like overturn a decision or, you know, JR us or whatever. I don't know. It just felt that, you know, we weren't able to be bold without fear of being challenged by the Secretary of State. At least now we don't have those kind of culture wars to be dealing with anymore. And if we do, you know, if there are any challenges, we can have proper grown-up conversations about it and not hear about it in the Telegraph or whatever.
Well, I think I've often said, if you live in Lambeth, you're a professional of sorts. You're either a consultant, a journalist, or some other professional. That's probably why attention's always pointed at the borough. And we know that, I would say, actually, that the former Secretary of State, Michael Gove, picked on Lambeth in many respects, not least because it's leading the way on issues that he may not agree with, but it was a kind of stick to beat a Labour local authority, which I promised I wouldn't be political before we came on, but here we are.
But it's a fact. It's a fact. I mean, even now, you know, we in Lambeth, when it comes to anything to do with climate and environment, anything to do with social housing, you know, we're easy targets for some of the right-wing press, and, you know, that's fine, because we know how to deal with a hostile press.
Exactly. And on that, curbside strategies aren't something that every borough has embraced yet, and it's no secret that Lambeth has faced its fair share of negative press and challenges, and yourself even abuse for just being at the forefront of this shift. What would you say your message is to listeners on your approach to the big shift? And I think just that might finally, looking 10 years into the future, what's your vision for Lambeth, and how do you think the borough will look and feel if everything goes to plan?
So, that's a big question.
I'm full but of big questions today.
Yeah, full of big questions. I mean, but very important questions. I mean, ultimately, the advice I'd give is just hold your nerve. Just hold your nerve, because yes, there will be people who just don't want other people to have nice things, because you know, they see it as taking something away from them, or they just don't want people to have the freedoms that they have, and you know, whether that be, you know, talking about transport, whether that be around housing, you know, people not wanting developments because it spoils their view. when you consider the number of people we have on the waiting list for housing, you know, it's ridiculous, the reasons and the length some people get to go to block development, and similarly with, you know, people who drive everywhere, you know, just throwing their toys out of the pram when a healthy neighbourhood goes in because we've suddenly prevented them from driving through a road. Well, actually, no, we've just made your journey a little bit longer, a little more inconvenience. People who walk and cycle have that inconvenience all the time. So, you know, this is about equity. And the vision for Lambeth is that, you know, if all goes to plan, you would want it to be a place where people feel safe, people feel valued, people feel that they have real prospects for for their future, for their families, their children, their grandchildren, that the quality of life will improve and not go back. People have, you know, a security of employment, income, and a roof over their head, and something to aspire to. But most of all, I think that, you know, we want people to be healthy, and that means creating an environment that people can thrive in.
Absolutely. And I was quite touched earlier when you mentioned the impact on your upbringing as a Bangladeshi woman of origin, and seeing the impact that climate change has had on the Global South. And we're recording in the week that parts of California, and particularly Pasadena, have seen, I'm not entirely sure the cause of it, but I'm sure it was exacerbated by the conditions that we're in. It's a difficult moment. I'm glad to see that places like Lambeth, where I once lived and also worked for, is really taking strides to try and address some of these really pressing concerns. I think just before we wrap up, how can residents and businesses listening today get involved and help Lambeth achieve its net zero target?
Well, so many ways. We have lots of community groups and fora for people to get involved in. We've recently launched our Lambeth Climate Partnership website, a portal where people can go in, log on, and they can find out all the activities that are going on in the borough with all our various anchor institutions as well, whether it's in science, in arts, in health. People can log on, get involved, and help us on this journey, because we can't do it by ourselves. We need everyone to join us.
Councillor Chowdhury, as you know, thank you so much for the time. And as we close today's discussion, it really reminds us that building a better city, but also better place, isn't just about policy. It's about the people who are there to serve and those policies that are in place. And Zina, you've shown us that how Lambeth is taking bold steps to lead London's sustainable transformation, but also how challenging it is to balance those ambitions with the day-to-day needs of residents and businesses. So for me, someone who works in public affairs and sees these debates play out on the ground, those conversations are really important about balancing sustainability with accessibility. And I think that's more relevant now more than ever. So, Zina, thank you for sharing your insights and for showing how local government is stepping up to tackle some of the most pressing issues of our time. To our listeners, welcome to 2025, and thank you so much for joining us. We have a brilliant range of guests, whether from industry or politics, like Councillor Rosina Chowdhury, the Deputy Leader and Cabinet Lead for Sustainable Lambeth and Clean Air. And I'll simply say, as a Londoner like myself navigating the city, we hope this episode leaves you inspired to think about how we can create better, fairer and more sustainable places for everyone. So see you next time, and thank you for listening to, and for the first time watching, the Better Places podcast.
Well, that's it from us. Thank you for listening to another episode of Better Places. You can listen to this on our website at conciliocomms.com/podcast. And don't forget to subscribe on whatever platform you listen on. Bye bye for now.